Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will examine sutta number 36 from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Maha Satchika Sutta. Now, last week we discussed the Mahabhayabhairava Sutta, which was Sutta number 4. And then that sutta gives one narrative account of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment. And so now that we've gotten him enlightened, we have to bring him back again to the state of a seeker and then trace his quest for enlightenment from another angle. This one will give greater details about the practices he undertook during his period of training for the attainment of enlightenment, with particular emphasis upon the ascetic practices he undertook, and then a very unique highlight of the way he discovered the path to enlightenment. Okay, and this sutta, or this narrative, unfolds within the context of a discussion with, and we call a disputant, a debater, who is named Satchika. According to the suttas, he was the son of a follower of the Niguntas. The Niguntas were the Jains. But it doesn't seem from the text that he was a Jain himself. But according to the commentary, he liked to go around whenever he heard about famous spiritual teachers, religious teachers. He liked to go around and debate with them and try to dispute and refute their theories, their teachings. And I didn't want to go into the beginning of the sutta, but to focus on the narrative. But just to put it in its place, the narrative in its place, if you've read the beginning parts of the sutta, you see that the discussion comes to focus upon the theme of two ideas which are called development of body and development of mind. And the way the outside ascetics, the samanas, the shramanas, and the brahmins, the non-Buddhist ascetics, understood the term development of body, or kaya bhavana, they identify this with the undertaking of the ascetic practices, the practice of self-mortification. And as to development of mind, according to the text, when they are asked about development of mind, they don't really have any idea what it means. But then the Buddha goes on to explain how one is undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind. And he explains one is undeveloped in body when one experiences a pleasant feeling. And then, because one has been touched by that pleasant feeling, here I'm in paragraph 8 of the sutta, one lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, this is how one is undeveloped in body. Okay, in that the pleasant feeling contacts one, and when one is touched by that pleasant feeling, then one lusts after it, and one craves for more pleasant feeling. That's being undeveloped in body. And one is undeveloped in mind when painful feeling arises, and the painful feeling invades the mind and persists because the mind is not developed. And so the Buddha, in the Buddha's teaching, development of body means that pleasant feeling affects one, one experiences pleasant feeling, but it doesn't obsess the mind and persist. And development of mind means that painful feeling, when it affects one, it doesn't obsess the mind and persist. And the commentary to the sutta explains that development of body means the development of insight, vipassana. That is because it's through insight that when pleasant feeling arises, one understands that the pleasant feeling is impermanent, unsatisfactory, insubstantial, and so one doesn't become attached to it. And then the commentary identifies development of mind with the development of samadhi or concentration. And that is because through development of mind, the painful feeling doesn't invade the mind and remain. So somebody who has developed strong samadhi, when he's affected by strong painful feelings, he's able to withdraw the mind from the painful feeling, painful bodily feeling, and just keep it focused internally so that the painful feeling doesn't overwhelm him. Okay, all of this is in a sense preliminary because it builds up to a point where the ascetic or the disputant named Satchika raises the question, he poses the question. Well, first he makes a statement to the Buddha saying, I have confidence in Master Gotama thus, this is paragraph 10, Master Gotama is developed in body and developed in mind. Then the Buddha says, he refers to Satchika by his, seems by his family name, Aggivesana. Surely, Aggivesana, your words are offensive and discourteous, but I will answer you. And I have to admit, I don't understand why the Buddha takes those words of Satchika to be offensive and discourteous. It seems like Satchika has made a statement extolling the Buddha and praising him. But perhaps all I could think of is that he might have said this with a sarcastic tone. But then the Buddha gives his answer and he says, since I shaved off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and went forth from the home life into homelessness, it has not been possible for arisen pleasant feeling to invade my mind and remain, or for arisen painful feeling to invade my mind and remain. And then Satchika asked the leading question, has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so pleasant it could invade his mind and remain? And has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so painful that it could invade his mind and remain? So these will be like the two main ideas around which the discourse will be woven. The idea of a very powerful, pleasant feeling that might obsess the mind in a very powerful, painful feeling that might obsess the mind. And the Buddha will give, as the answer to this question of Satchika, an account of his attainment of enlightenment, or the attainment of his quest for enlightenment, showing how in the course of this quest, he experienced both the extremes of painful feeling without being overwhelmed by them, and also the most exalted heights of pleasant feeling without being carried away by them. Okay, now the Buddha begins by saying that here, before my enlightenment, while I was still only in an unenlightened bodhisattva, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty, life gone forth. Gone forth means gone forth, leaving behind the home and the household life is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. This is a kind of stock passage which occurs many, many times in the suttas. We often find it related, was spoken of not in relation to the Buddha, but just choosing a young person in general, showing the kind of thoughts that go into his mind and lead that person to the act of renunciation and to the adoption of the life of a monk. And so later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life and so forth, all the rest is at sutta number 26, which we already discussed. And actually, this takes us through, it covers a lot of the narrative portion of sutta number 26. From 14 to 17, we have here the story about the bodhisattva leaving his home, then going to seek instruction from first Alara Kalama, gaining the ability to attain the base of nothingness in meditation, then becoming dissatisfied with that, leaving Alara, seeking another teacher, finding Udakka Ramaputta, studying under Udakka Ramaputta, learning from him how to attain the base of neither perception nor non-perception, attaining it, then being appointed by Udakka as the head of the community, rejecting that because he finds this attainment insufficient, then leaving and going off on his own, and finding a suitable place, a very beautiful, peaceful, quiet place. This was at Uluvela, at Senanigama. And then sitting down there thinking, this will serve for striving. But in sutta number 26, when the Buddha sits there thinking this will serve for striving, then it goes immediately into the account of his enlightenment, as though he attained enlightenment immediately, as soon as he sat down. But here this sutta branches off in a different direction, gives a different account. Okay, now according to the text and the sequence that we have here, when the Buddha sat down in order to undertake this striving, three similes occurred to him spontaneously, never heard before. He says, suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. And now for us moderns, this the term of the simile might be rather not so easily comprehensible, because when we want to light a fire, we just take a book of matches and strike the match against the side panel. But in ancient India, they didn't have matches, and even up till modern times, nobody had matches. But when you wanted to make a fire, you had to take a piece of what they call two sticks especially made for producing fire, and rub them against each other until a certain degree of heat builds up, and then I guess sparks are given off, and one uses those sparks to light the fire. I don't have any personal experience with this myself. Okay, so in this case we have a man finding a wet, sappy piece of water, a piece of wood which has been lying in water, and then he takes an upper fire stick and he thinks to produce fire by rubbing together the fire stick with this wet, sappy piece of water. And certainly by doing so, he's not able to produce fire. And the man reaps only weariness and disappointment. And so now the Buddha continues, as to those recluses and Brahmins, or ascetics and Brahmins, samana brahmana, who do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics, recluses, and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Okay, so in this simile, we have the wet, sappy wood, piece of wood, lying in water. Here, lying in water means or corresponds to an ascetic, a practitioner, still physically enjoying sensual pleasures, but seeking enlightenment while enjoying sensual pleasures. And wet and sappy, the wood being wet and sappy inside, means that within that ascetic sensual desire, what are the terms, affection, infatuation, and so on, have not been overcome internally, have not been at least stilled and silenced and quieted down through the practice of concentration or samadhi. So in this case, if those ascetics undertake the very extreme ascetic practices, they are not capable of gaining supreme enlightenment. And if they don't practice, undertake the ascetic practices, they're still not capable of attaining supreme enlightenment. So we could say that in their case, the two obstacles to attaining enlightenment are, one, being involved physically in the enjoyment of the sensual pleasures, and internally not suppressing or stilling sensual desire through the practice of samadhi. And in that case, the ascetic practices will be completely useless or futile, not capable of leading to enlightenment. Okay, now, simile two. Does that the book that everybody have read exactly the same as I've been reading it? Because in an earlier edition of this Majjhima Nikaya, it followed the Burmese script edition, which was somewhat different, and so the translation came out differently. But then I found that the Pali Text Society and the Sinhala script edition are better. Okay, now we come to the second simile that occurred to him. Okay, paragraph 18. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of water, a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking to make a fire. And could he produce a fire? The answer is no. And why not? Because he's using a wet, sappy piece of wood, even though it's on dry land, but because the wood is wet and sappy, it's not conducive to the production of a fire. And so now the Buddha applies the simile. Eva meva agivesana. As to those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, in other words, they've embarked upon a life of outward renunciation, but whose sensual desire, affection, and so on has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally, that is, through the practice of concentration or samadhi. Even if those good ascetics feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment, And even if those good, the recluses and Brahmins, do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Okay, so in this case, for the ascetic, the recluse or Brahmin to attain supreme enlightenment, he's met one requisite, one prerequisite, one condition, that he's living physically withdrawn from sensual pleasures. He leads a life of restraint, of abstinence. But he doesn't have any method or technique for training the mind, and so the sensual desire has not been stilled or silenced internally. And so in this case, again, whether he undertakes the ascetic practices or doesn't undertake them, he's not capable of supreme enlightenment. Okay, now the third simile occurs. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. Could this man produce heat by rubbing against the dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? And the answer is yes, because the piece of wood is on dry land far from water, and it is a dry, sapless piece of wood. So both conditions are met. And then the Buddha says, and so for those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures and whose sensual desire and so forth has been fully abandoned and suppressed internally, even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to their exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetic recluses and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the third simile that occurred to me. Okay, so in this simile, wait, let me just finish. Both conditions are met, being withdrawn from sensual pleasures, physically withdrawn, and having succeeded in stilling the mind, removing the sensual desires from the mind. And in this case, whether the practitioner engages in self-mortification in the ascetic practices or not makes no difference. He's still capable of attaining supreme enlightenment. And so from all three similes, the obvious conclusion follows that the ascetic practices, whether one undertakes them or not, makes no difference to one's ability to attain enlightenment. What is necessary, according to the Bodhisattva's conclusion at this point, is physical withdrawal from sense pleasures and the removal of the mind from its attachment to sensual pleasures. Okay, you had a question?
Yeah. Here it says, abandoning desire leads to knowledge and vision. But I thought it was supposed to be the other way around, that when you have insight, that leads to the abandoning of desire.
And there's actually different ways in which the abandoning takes place. What is meant here is the withdrawal of the mind from its involvement with sensual desires through the attainment of deep concentration, which will serve as the basis for insight to arise. And it's when the insight arises that it cuts off the deep underlying tendency or disposition towards sensual craving.
Okay, so it's withdrawing versus uprooting.
That's a good word, uprooting. It's uprooting that takes place through insight or through the maturation of wisdom. But here, what is called, you call this, it's a kind of temporary abandoning through the cultivation of concentration. In the commentaries, they develop a distinction. They call one, one is called, cutting off a samucheda bahana. Boy, my... It will come to me. But anyway, there's another Pali term which means suppression. Vikambana bahana. That's through samadhi, the defilements are abandoned by suppression. It's like pushing them out of the way so that they don't become active and operative. But through the maturation of panya, wisdom, samucheda, which means cutting off, eradication, uprooting. Okay, now this is interesting, what comes next. Because here now the Buddha says, okay, I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Actually, I just thought of this from another angle. Okay, so then with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. Okay, the rest you could read on for yourself. I don't have to explain this in detail. What struck me as rather strange, and which makes me suspect that the sequence in the sutta has gotten jumbled in the course of transmission, because the conclusions that the Bodhisattva has just come to about the uselessness of ascetic practices for the attainment of enlightenment should be the kind of conclusion that he comes to after he has undertaken all the ascetic practices and then sees that they're useless. And then he should think, okay, since the ascetic practices are useless, then I have to find some other way to enlightenment.
Is it possible that when he says these similes occurred to him, is it possible he's saying they're occurring to him right now in his conversation?
No. He's indicating that the similes occurred to him. The text definitely uses the past tense here, and it gives the impression that the similes occurred to him while he sat there striving. And even the commentary accepts it in that sense, and it gives, I have to say, an unconvincing explanation why the Bodhisattva undertook the ascetic practices after coming to the conclusion that they're useless. One, I give the commentary explanation in note 387. That's on page 1229. Or actually, the commentary explanation is on 1230. The commentary says that the Bodhisattva undertook this practice of austerities to show to the world his own exertion, then to show that the quality of energy gave him joy. And second, he did so out of compassion for later generations to inspire them to strive with the same determination that he applied to the attainment of enlightenment. But I've tried to reassemble the pieces of the sutta into a somewhat different structure. And there are also some other portions of the sutta which seem to be out of proper sequence. I'll come to those later. Okay, and so now, with paragraph 20, the Bodhisattva undertakes this kind of very painful type of austere meditation practice, clenching the teeth, pressing the tongue against the roof of the mouth, and trying to crush his mind with the mind. And then here the key phrase is towards the end of the paragraph, although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. This goes back to the question of the ascetic Satchika, whether the Buddha had ever experienced such terrible, painful feeling. Okay, then the Buddha goes on to describe the other types of meditation he practiced. Next comes something called the breathingless or the non-breathing meditation, where he stops his breath. Then there comes a loud sound of winds from his ear holes. And then he experiences terrible pain. But again, his energy is aroused, his mindfulness is established, but the painful feeling doesn't overpower his mind. Then he carries this non-breathing meditation further, step by step, and then there come similes to illustrate the severity, the extremity of the pain that he's experiencing. Okay, till we come to paragraph 26. Okay, here he says, now when deities saw me, some said, the recluse Gotama is dead. Other deities said, the recluse Gotama is not dead, he is dying. And other deities said, the recluse Gotama is not dead nor dying, he is an arahant, for such is the way that the arahants abide. Again, it strikes me, this paragraph again seems to be out of sequence. And this is the way, let me take the paragraphs in the way I would put them in sequence. Okay, I would say after the last paragraph on the non-breathing meditation, then I would go to paragraph 28. I thought, suppose I take very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup, lentil soup, or vetch soup. I don't know what vetch soup is. Or pea soup. And so he takes very little food. Then I would say, perhaps after some time taking very little food, then I would put the passage at number 27, where he thinks to himself, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food, since it makes sense to be undertaking these ascetic practices in increasing degrees of severity. So one begins reducing the food, then one thinks to cut it off entirely. Okay, and when he does this, then there are certain beings we call devatas who dwell in the proximity of the earth. Apparently, they were attracted to the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva somehow would have been able to see them. And they came to him and they said, first they tried to convince him not to cut off food entirely, but they said, if you do cut off food entirely, we will infuse celestial or heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and so you can live on that. But then the bodhisattva rejected this and said that if I claim to be fasting while the deities are infusing this nutritious divine substance into my body, it's like living on intravenous feeding system while claiming not to be taking any food, so one can grow quite plump and hefty even though everybody thinks one is fasting. Okay, so the Buddha rejects this. Then I would think that we come to the passage where his body reaches a state. It seems that this body reaching the state of extreme emaciation could follow from taking very little food. Because again, he says, because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. And so in all of these passages concern what happened because of eating so little. Then because of eating so little, he reached a point where if he wanted to touch his belly, he was able to touch his backbone. If he went to touch his backbone, his hand would come through to his belly. And so because of eating so little, and if I defecated or urinated, I fell over on my face there, right there. And because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair, which had been rotten at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. Though if his body was so weak at this point, then it would make little sense for him to entirely cut off food afterwards. So perhaps that's this part of the sequence is correct, that he entirely cuts off food first, and then subsequently decides to take a little food, and then he becomes so weak that he falls over. Okay, then now some people, when they saw me, that's the color of his skin changes. So some people think that he was black-skinned, others brown-skinned, others golden-skinned. His skin originally had a very clear, bright color, but the skin had turned dark through his ascetic practices. It would seem at the point where he falls over on his face because of eating so little, that this should be the point where paragraph 26 comes. When deities saw me, some said that the ascetic, the recluse Gotama is dead. Others said the recluse Gotama is not dead, but he's dying. And others said the recluse Gotama is not dead or dying. He is an arhat. Anyway, these are some of my theories. But now at paragraph 30, here now the Bodhisattva draws the conclusion. He says, whatever recluses or ascetics in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superior human states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Now, this whole period in which the Bodhisattva is engaged in these ascetic practices, though it seems to be taking place maybe over a period of weeks or months, but when we know the Buddhist account of the Buddha's life, we find that it takes place over a period of 6 years. And there are other descriptions of his ascetic practices in Sutta number 12, Majjhima number 12. I gave the paragraphs in the list of reading. Okay, it seems to me that it's at this point, after the Bodhisattva has reached the conclusion that this practice of austerities, that through this practice of austerities, he has not been able to attain any distinction and knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, it seems to me that it is here that the three similes, the similes of the piece of wood, the wet, sappy piece of wood in water, out of water, and the dry wood should come. And it's at that point that he should draw the conclusion that the practice of austerities is absolutely useless. And then he poses to himself the question, could there be another path to enlightenment? And then he considers, you're in paragraph 31, I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure, born of seclusion. Now this incident that he recalls is not recorded in the canonical texts themselves. And so the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya provides an explanation of what this is referring to. It explains that when the Bodhisattva was a child, I believe, I don't remember the age that it gives, but he was still a very, very little child, perhaps even an infant, there was a plowing festival that was held annually in the state in which he was living. And his father was the ruler of that state. And so all of the land cultivators would go to plow their land. This would probably be the beginning of the cultivating season. And his father, as the ruler, would be the leader in the act of cultivation. And he would have a golden plow with which he would plow the land. And so when that ceremony took place, they brought the little baby prince on a couch covered by a net, I guess a mosquito net, and they left it under a tree. And his father and all of the other farmers and people, citizens, all went to the field for the plowing ceremony. And while the little infant child was resting in the shade of the tree, for some reason, just spontaneously, he sat up, crossed his legs, and began attending to his in and out breathing. And as he was attending to the breathing, the mind became concentrated, and he entered into the first jhana. And then, of course, the commentary has to give a somewhat supernatural feature to the story. It explains that the Bodhisattva prince continued sitting in that meditative state for some time, and the sun, of course, would have been moving across the sky. And as the sun moved across the sky, the shadows of all of the other trees moved in accordance with the motion of the sun. But the shadow that was covering the Bodhisattva still remained unmoving in order to keep him cool and fresh. And so when his father came back and saw this, and all of the other people saw this, they realized that this was a miracle. And then his father, though the father was the ruler, and this was just his son, infant son, but the father bowed down in veneration to the son. In the Sanskrit versions, in the Mahavastu version, they have that four rishis, these are four sages, five sages were flying across the sky on this occasion. But when they came to the part of the sky just above where the Bodhisattva was meditating, they couldn't advance any further. And they were puzzled about the reason for this, and so they descended to earth, and then they saw the Bodhisattva sitting in meditation under the tree, and they recited verses in expressing their veneration towards him. Okay, so the features of the story differ in one from one account to another, but the important point is that here the Bodhisattva, at this point in his quest for enlightenment, has realized that the path of self-mortification, of extreme asceticism, is futile, useless, unproductive. And seeking some other way to enlightenment, he's come to a recollection of this boyhood experience of the first meditative absorption, first jhana. And then the question comes into his mind, could this be the path to enlightenment? And then following on that memory came the realization, that is the path to enlightenment. And when that thought came to his mind, there might have been some doubt coming up along with it, some hesitation, some reluctance to accept that conclusion. The reason being that it was such an established principle of Indian spirituality during that period, that the practice of asceticism is the way to enlightenment, that to just, and that any kind of pleasure, any kind of joy is to be shunned, is dangerous, is fearful. That he might have thought that the pleasure, the joy, the rapture, the pleasure of this meditative experience, maybe that this is the seduction of Mara, of the evil one, rather than the true way to enlightenment. So he must have paused and reflected on this for some time before coming to that conclusion that this is the way to enlightenment. Because then he thinks in paragraph 32, why am I afraid of that pleasure which has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? And then he made a kind of determination to himself, I am not afraid of that pleasure since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. And now here, I can raise an interesting and rather puzzling question, which I don't have a definite answer to myself. When the Bodhisattva was practicing with training under his first two meditation teachers, Alara and Uddaka Ramaputta, he was able to, he learned the practice for attaining the base of nothingness and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Now these are, we call, formless meditative absorptions, the arupa jhanas. And in the traditional account of the Buddhist meditative training, to get to one meditative absorption, one has to go through the lower ones. And so, to get to the third formless attainment, it would seem, one would have to learn first the first jhana, master that, then master the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, then go to the base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, then come to the base of nothingness. And so, it seems, though the texts don't say this, that when the Bodhisattva was training under these first two teachers, he would have learned the jhanas under them as well. But when he has this recollection, or when he's thinking about another way to enlightenment, he doesn't recall the attainment of jhanas under those teachers. But he recalls this boyhood experience of the first jhana only. So the question that comes up, why is this? Anybody have any ideas? He would have been in a very pure state, yeah. Yeah. You mean, would the memories have remained with him? Yeah. I don't know whether those memories would have remained with him. I don't know. Yeah. Perhaps, yeah. Any other? I don't have a definite answer, so it's not like I'm trying to test you to see whether you get it right or not. Yeah.
I know we're talking about order. So he definitely went and learned from those two before he did the ascetic practice?
Oh, definitely so, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
State of nothingness.
There's still a feeling in that state of nothingness. It's a very, very subtle, very refined, equanimous feeling. It's not pleasant, not painful. Yeah. Sukhi. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's a good point. But when he was, it seems, when he was studying under the two teachers, Alara and Uddaka, at that point he was not yet doing the really severe, painful ascetic practices. But they were, I get the impression that they were living in quiet communities, devoted to meditation, rather than to the rough, afflictive types of practices that he undertook later. This I don't know. I don't know. We don't have rose apple in this country, I guess. It's a very very pleasant fruit. I like it. Yeah. A luxury. Maybe so, maybe so. But generally the ascetics would stay under the shade of, well, often they would stay under the shades of trees. Though some would expose themselves to the heat of the sun during the hot season and the cold of the open air during the cold season. Did some yeah.
Could it be that he stood with his prior two teachers as, well, that didn't work?
Mm.
So he's at this point saying, maybe there's some other way.
Yeah.
That this was the thought that came.
Yeah.
So there's some other way.
Yeah.
Didn't I ever get to some sort of level without one of these ways that doesn't work?
That's a very good way. That's a very good explanation, yeah.
Let me go and think about this way that
yeah.
Was there any other point in my life where I reached...
That's a very good way of understanding it.
Now
he's to discover his own way, whereas he would have learned that, suppose he did learn the jhanas under those teachers, he would have learned them from a teacher, and so it would show that he was taking something which he was depending upon... that he was depending or relying upon something that he had learned from another teacher. But now he's going to use this jhanic experience as a way of setting off in his own direction and exploring on his own. Georgette, did you have your hand? Okay. I have a theory of my own. Do you have an explanation? Oh. Actually, I had two ways of understanding this. It seems that they're both hypothetical, that when training under the two previous teachers, Alara and Udaka, since those teachers advocated that formless meditation as the supreme goal of their own dhammas, their own systems, even if one attains the jhana in that system, one doesn't spend much time in it. One just attains it very briefly in order to pass on quickly to go up and to reach the highest formless attainment possible in their system. And so when practicing with those teachers, the Bodhisattva never really considered this state as something to be made solid, you know, to be made firm, to be developed, to be explored, but just use it as a kind of quick stepping stone onto the next stage in order to get to the highest formless attainment. Another hypothetical explanation, actually now three come to mind. This is the second. Perhaps in those systems there are ways to get to the formless absorptions that don't proceed through the jhanas. Maybe they use some type of device, I don't know what kind of device it could be, some technique which will bring the mind, perhaps visualizing the infinity of space or imagining, conceiving infinite space, and then just thinking space is infinite. And perhaps those meditators would go directly, once their faculties are strong and mature enough, they'll go directly into the formless attainment without having to pass step by step through the jhanas. That's my second explanation. The third explanation relates to this theme of the sutta in which the Buddha is trying to show how he experienced first certain very painful states without being overwhelmed or crushed by them. And so he discusses, there he relates his ascetic practices. And then the other theme is that of how he experienced certain pleasant states without being carried away by them. And so now the jhanas will be introduced as a way to show what are those pleasant states that he experienced without being carried away by them, without being obsessed by them. And also another point just comes to mind, and that is a cardinal feature of the Buddha's teaching is that it's the middle way, in that it's a way which doesn't reject pleasure, happiness, and joy per se, but does accept joy and happiness when they are wholesome. And so now the Buddha wants to introduce the jhanas as a way of showing this kind of wholesome joy and happiness. And his attitude towards the jhanas, if he did attain them when practicing under the two teachers, they might have had the attitude that the joy and happiness of the jhanas is something to be discarded, something to be looked upon even with fear, and with something that one should immediately become detached from in order to gain the equanimity of the formless attainments. But here now the Buddha wants to hold up the jhanas as being happy, pleasurable, joyful states which can be used as a way to gain enlightenment. I think by remain, in the case of pleasant feeling, excuse me? Okay, in the case of pleasant feeling, the pleasant feeling arises and that's invading the mind, and it remains, and that the mind becomes attached to the pleasant feeling. And so one goes on desiring repetition of that pleasant feeling, intensification of it, deepening of it. Then the painful feeling, what's the expression? Invades the mind and remains. That means when the painful feeling arises, then the mind gets crushed or overwhelmed by the painful feeling and is not able to endure it or to withstand it with equanimity. That's the way I would understand it. Yeah. Any questions? Yeah.
One day you said something about accepting joy and happiness when they are wholesome.
Right, yeah.
Could you just define a little bit what is wholesome so that we don't misunderstand what joy and happiness, a wholesome kind of joy and happiness means?
Okay, according to this sutta here, it's the joy and happiness that arise. Of course, there's joy and happiness that arise in many states of consciousness. But here, the Buddha is specifically pinpointing the joy and happiness in the first jhana. But to take a broader perspective of wholesome and unwholesome joy and happiness, Buddhism distinguishes states of consciousness into wholesome and unwholesome states. And what defines a state of consciousness as wholesome or unwholesome are the associated mental factors, particularly three factors which are called the root factors of the state of consciousness. So states of consciousness which are rooted in the three unwholesome roots, that's craving, desire or greed, hatred, aversion, dislike, and then ignorance or delusion, those are unwholesome states of consciousness. And so there are experiences of pleasure which arise in those unwholesome states of consciousness, particularly when greed or desire or craving is satisfied. And one eats delicious food, one becomes happy. That's an unwholesome state of consciousness. Kind of joy or happiness that arises in an unwholesome state of consciousness. Some people, they get a new car and they can drive around and show off and shame their neighbors with their new car. That gives them a certain pleasure, but that pleasure, it's rooted in the defiled mental state, so it's unwholesome. Or one gets revenge on an enemy and one feels some gratification for doing so, as we see in the world when particularly Israelis and Palestinians destroy members of each other's communities and they feel happy. Okay, that brings some happiness which is rooted in aversion or hatred, so that's unwholesome. Okay, but then there are wholesome states of consciousness these are states of consciousness rooted in the three wholesome roots. Technically, they're called non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. But non-greed means generosity or detachment. So when one gives something to help, say, poor people, one experiences some joy or happiness because of the thought that one is helping to alleviate the suffering of others. So that's a wholesome joy or happiness. Or one, say, when one undertakes the precepts, one realizes when observing pure conduct, then one feels joy or happiness. That's a pure, wholesome type of conduct. Or when one does Buddha puja, veneration of the Buddha, or focuses the mind on the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, then one feels joy or happiness. That is a wholesome type of happiness. So, generosity, non-aversion or loving kindness, or punya or wisdom. Through non-aversion, when one develops loving kindness or states of mind associated with loving kindness, there comes joy and happiness that's wholesome. And when one develops wisdom, understanding of the Dharma, insight into the teachings of the Dharma, insight into direct insight experiences, then it's wholesome joy and happiness. And so normally in our day-to-day practice, we have to eliminate and weed out the unwholesome states and cultivate wholesome states and build up a certain momentum, wholesome momentum in the mind. And then that will provide a foundation for developing, we call the superior wholesome states, like the jhanas. Okay, I think we should stop at this, unless there's any further questions. Then we stop at this point, and next week I will finish this sutta, which should not take a long time, and then come back to Majjhima number 26. We sort of